Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and there are many impressive accomplishments I can share with you about today's guest. Starting with, she is a psychologist, an educator, a nationally recognized family, child development, and human behavior expert. She's an author, a lecturer, and a former PBS TV show host. She contributes frequently to broadcast, print, and online media outlets as a healthcare expert, and she hosts the CNN radio show, Let's Talk. Her work has been a focus on The Today Show, The O'Reilly Factor, ABC, NBC, The Doctors, People Magazine, Parenting Magazine, The New York Times, and other major print and media outlets. Today's guest has earned praise and admiration from distinguished leaders, Arianna Huffington, Dr. Dean Ornish, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who has bestowed upon her the Spirit of Freedom Award, one of the numerous honors and awards she has received. She has interviewed the rich and famous, achieved great success professionally and personally. When she is asked about the person who influenced her the most, she is fortunate to reply, "I always answer without hesitation that my husband, of 45 years, is my greatest teacher. He really is the kind of person that we all strive to be." So our guest today is highly educated, accomplished, and beloved, and yet I know of no one who would trade their life with hers. As Dr. Gail Gross, author of the book, The Only Way Out is Through, has experienced in the most devastating way, hell on earth. Her recently published book is her story and her work, which offers all of us a 10-step journey for dealing with catastrophic loss. She is here today to share it with us. A very special welcome to a very special guest, Dr. Gail Gross. Thank you for being on Living Above the Drama today.
Oh, thank you for that beautiful, beautiful beginning. That just wonderful. And it's so. And thank you for having me, Georgiana. It's so interesting that you said, you know, no one would change places with me. That's so perceptive. Often people say to me, you know, we would love to have your life. And I always say, stop and think about it. Really?
You really? Well, I want to share with the audience. I love doing this radio show because to me, life is about connecting with people who have the courage and the heart and the soul to not only have the ability and the willingness to liberate themselves, but to help us liberate ourselves from this incredible complexity called life. And Gail Gross has really just touched my heart, and I'm sure is going to touch your heart, with her story of courage, of devastation, and of recovery, and of resurrection. It's so moving, and I don't want to taint it in any way. So, Gail, I'm going to ask you to please, by the way, I did read the chapter by your son. Unbelievable. We are going to get to talk about that. What? Would you start and please tell your story?
Well, my story began on April 12th, 1990, when we received, my husband and I, that proverbial terrifying phone call in the middle of the night, telling us that our daughter had died. And in that second, everything we knew, everything we were, changed. Our lives were altered forevermore. And the rest of that evening, my husband and I never sat down. We just packed, cried. We were on a trip and had to figure out how to get home. We tried to reach our son. He was at school. We couldn't reach him. And so we left word on his tape to stay in his room that we would come to speak with him. And with that, we boarded a plane, holding hands and crying, just completely deconstructing in front of our eyes, and flew home. I flew to get our son. And I remember calling my mother from the airport to tell her what had happened and realizing that people were all around me and listening. And it was something beyond my control. I just had to reach back for my mother and had to tell her what had transpired and then have her call my brother and so forth. But it was like swimming in a vortex. And, of course, from there on, you just have to try to find your bearings as you, little by little, step by step, dissolve into grief. And at some point, moving through that process, you have a choice, and you choose whether to go on or to die. And you realize it really is a choice, that you have to decide where to go with the rest of your life if you can go on. And I chose life, and therefore I had to figure out how to live it. And I remember thinking to myself, it's no sense to choose life and making everyone around you miserable. I had a son who needed me and a husband who needed me, both of whom I loved dearly. And so I sat back and thought, what can I do with the rest of my life that's constructive? Because my life, as I knew it, was over. So I had to create a new normal, a new life. And I went about researching and thinking how to do that. And that's what this book is about.
It's also, I believe, a roadmap of how those of us, we all have, you and I shared and agreed, in everyone's life, there is great suffering and loss at some point or another. And you provide a roadmap with how to take steps to begin to reclaim as much as possible of who you are and the life you want to move forward to, because you can never go back. You can never reclaim your life as it was.
No, you're forever altered. And really, that life is a transition. It's an ending. And in many cultures, they have rituals for endings, but we don't really have such in our culture. And so we have to create them for ourselves. But it is true that you cannot go home again, so to speak. And you have to go through the process. And what I lay out in this book, this roadmap, so to speak, really are the steps that I used, not really to reclaim the life that was, but to transition into a different life, a new life. And in a sense, it's a rebirth, really. And Jung, Carl Jung, really used the resurrection as a model for transformation, recognizing that there has to be something new that comes out of us. He called it a transcendent function that brought new life. But when you go into an inversion or an inner period, which, of course, grief is, you have the opportunity to do inner work. And it's that inner work that helps you move forward. And that requires consciousness. We all, as you say, live lives of suffering and happiness. You know, we have little deaths all day long. If someone is nice to you, you're happy. If someone hurts your feelings, you feel annihilated and alienated. And we go through these steps of little births and little deaths all day long. But when something catastrophic happens to us, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the loss of a child. It can be a divorce. It can be a change of job. It can be the loss of a great friendship. It can be empty nest, any transition, because endings signal beginnings, but they also signal transitioning. You have to transition into those new beginnings. And my approach, which is really a version of Carl Jung's approach, really does lay out a way to travel into a new you. And the new you is always bigger and better than the you left behind. And that's because it's conscious. In the valley of despair, I call it, that place that you fall into when grief first hits you, is that place without familiar structures. Why? And it's why all of us feel very vulnerable and young when in trauma of any kind. And because there are no structures, we often run back to what's familiar, the you we were, and we try to make that fit. We go back to our family of origin. We go back to the patterns of our family of origin. But that can't serve us anymore. Now we have to hang out in the valley of despair, hold the tension where there are no comfortable structures, and hold ourselves from going back, from lowering our anxiety, and doing inner work to, in a sense, reclaim, and this is where reclaiming does come in, reclaim the disowned parts of ourselves that we all have, because that's what it is to be socialized. You know, Freud's great line, the cost of civilization is neurosis. We all have to give up, we have to disown those natural parts of ourselves. And Jung called it the shadow. We have to integrate that back consciously into ourselves, Because that, in that shadow, is where the fertility for the rest of our life is. And if we have the courage to go forward instead of backward, the best is really yet to be. Now, yeah, do you ever recover from loss? Of course not. That was a person or a friend or a job that you loved. But can you live a vital, happy life? Yes. And in a way, more vitally, with more libido, because you're conscious. You're not using projections, which we can talk about later, or using patterns that no longer fit for you.
Right. I mean, what you and I shared during the pre-interview, and it's always so nice to have someone who's an expert in the field share thoughts with you. But the whole notion that, you know, we really die on some level when we have a great loss,
yes,
whether it's a love or whatever it is. And in that death, there is a physical, there's an emotional, there's a neurological, there's a spiritual, there are many levels of trauma and challenge that we go through. So while we all want to believe and look forward to processing any kind of major loss, coming out the other end with new skills and new depth and new dimension, there's the issue of getting through the real mourning, the real trauma, the real devastation that we go through. You were kind enough to direct me to what your son wrote in the book, and I read it. And for those who are listening, Gail's son wrote his experience of his sister's death, and it was just deeply, deeply moving. And I think we have a tendency to think of major loss as belonging to, like, you know, the spouse or the partner or the parent or someone who is kind of the attached to the individual that we lose. But we don't think about what could only be called the other intimates with people. And in this particular case, you know, there can be a lot of sibling trauma, but this was profound. Do you want to do two things right now? Do you want to talk about Dawn? Please talk to us about her. And then talk about her relationship with her brother and what it was that he has been able to accomplish since her death 28 years ago.
Well, Dawn was one of these very kind, compassionate young women. In fact, that's really how she died. She was taking care of a friend who was sick, visiting a friend really, but bringing bread and soup, and that friend had a terrible virus. And the virus went to Dawn's heart, and that was the virus that killed Dawn. And my favorite story about Dawn was when she was a little girl, around 13, she was invited to a sleepover, but another friend of hers was not. And Dawn gave up her place at the sleepover so that her other friend wouldn't be alone, because she was the only one left out. Of course, now there was another place at the sleepover, and so the other little girl was next on the list, and she was invited. And she
went. Irony. The irony, of course, yes.
And she went, and I said to Dawn, "Dawn, how does that make you feel? Can you really go on with this friendship?" And she said, "Oh, yes, Mother, because my friend has so many good qualities. This is, I grant you, not a good one, but she has a lot of others, and I like her." And that's who Dawn was. She was a very kind, open person. She really wasn't limited by small thinking. In fact, if she broke up with a boyfriend, they stayed friends. You know, she just had that open, I always say, in a sense, she was very much like my husband and picked up a lot of his characteristics along the way. And he sort of is like that. He doesn't get caught up in small grievances. And she was very magnanimous in her personality. And she loved her brother. And when he was born, it was her baby. And she took him to school for show and tell. And there was just enough years between them, the 3 years between, that she was ready to move off my knee when he was ready to move on. And she wasn't jealous. And she always took him everywhere, always. So they grew up very, very close. And they were best friends. They were confidants. They shared friends. And So it was a huge loss for Sean. He lost his friend, his sister, his confidant, and it was very, you know, as when everyone is suffering, it's very hard to recognize each individual because you're so destroyed. And that was my situation. And it was later that I realized, really a day later, how destroyed Sean was. And then I really talked with him about it and continued to monitor and talk and engage. But I realized that siblings are left out so often because parents are protecting their children and children are protecting their parents. So the children have never seen their parents fragile before, and now they withhold or suppress their feelings to help their parents.
Right.
And that's why I asked Sean to write this memoir, because at the end of the day, you know, our memories also are very attached to our feelings, and so our perspectives are different. And so my courage was to choose to have Sean write this memoir because I knew that his perspective would be different, and I thought it would be interesting and helpful for others to read what a sibling was going through and how he viewed
it. It was deeply, deeply touching. And
yeah.
We're going to take a break. We're through our first break here, and we're going to take a break, and when I come back, I would like permission to read from your book two paragraphs that Sean wrote.
Oh, great.
And then I would like to ask you to please share with the audience how moved the coroner was
yes.
when he found your daughter and her poise and her peace and her beauty and how he responded, which was quite remarkable, that you know that this was... You know that this was a special soul. So don't go away, anybody. This is one of the really most meaningful and moving interviews. So I invite you to stay there. We're going to come back in just a minute with more Being with Dr. Gail Gross.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful peer presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. a true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gaz is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
And we are back with Dr. Gail Gross, who is the author of a remarkable book, The Only Way Out is Through. And the book is about her extraordinary experience as a human being and a mother and a therapist and a person of the world who has been through what can only really be called hell on earth. There's no other way to describe it. Before the break, I asked Gail's permission to read something that her son Sean wrote in her book. This is what he wrote in his chapter. "What I do remember with absolute clarity is this. My parents were crushed. I watched them throughout the funeral, and I saw them in a way I never had before. I saw my mother cry and grieve when her father died. I saw my father cry and grieve when his mother died. And then 6 weeks later, I saw him cry and grieve again when his father died. My parents were both very close to their parents, and they suffered mightily through their losses. But in my 21 years of life, I had never seen them like this. They were just utterly defeated and deflated. They were stripped down to their most basic elements. They were raw and injured, devastated. More than anything, what I noticed and realized was just how fragile they were. In the blink of an eye, what had been brewing at a subconscious level was elevated to that of conscience. My parents were frail, fragile beings who were utterly broken by the death of my sister. And they could die at any moment as a result of any number of internal and external threats. Put another way, I realized for the first time that my parents were just human. For the first time, I fully realized the consequences that come with being just human. In that instance, my fears relating to the safety and well-being of my family crystallized. It was a profound moment for me, and I've never quite recovered from it." I don't know that anyone could have articulated what those who go through utter devastation and loss. I don't think that anyone could have articulated that more clearly, the fragileness of life, the devastation, the unmasking, if you will, of our humanity, be we husband, wife, lover, partner, child, the unmasking of our fragileness and our humanity. So I'm going to ask you, if you would, Gail, to first speak about Dawn and the incredible touching story of those who found her in her bed, and then speak to Sean's writing, because it's so deeply, deeply moving.
Well, you know, no one has ever asked me this, even though I wrote about it in this book. I have many interviews I've had, or as many years have gone by, no one's ever asked me to tell them about Dawn. You're just a wonderful interviewer. Brilliant. She was really a lovely person. She was a little person, and she never spoke to me that she didn't hold my hand. And she was kind and caring, and she was very talented. She had gone to Emerson. She, in fact, she was in Who's Who and American colleges, and she was just a very talented young woman. She was wonderful at writing and producing and some acting, and she had gotten Second City before she died and another role. She actually died at the happiest time in her life because suddenly everything she wanted came to her, but she had fallen in love with a young man that is still very close to our family. In fact, he's the godfather for one of my grandchildren. And they were to marry, and she was going to come home, and she was on a temporary assignment, actually, and she was coming home in 10 days. And she said to me, "You know, Mom, I've just had a conversation with my friend Laura, and I've decided that though I've accomplished this and Second City has come to me and a part in a play as Sam Shepard's wife, I'm actually going to go home and dedicate myself to my family the way you did." And she was walking away from career for a while to be in love. And it was so sad that 10 days later, she was gone. Oh. And but she was a very kind, bright light for the time she was here. And she lived a very full life. She was very close to her friends. And in fact, when she died, she had so many friends come from all over because she had studied for 2 years at RADA in London. And she had studied at Yale, and she had graduated from Emerson. And in fact, another sweet story about Dawn, and she was always in politics at school, and the kids were having a rally, and they decided to have a march. And the president of the university was concerned that it would perhaps end up in something violent. So he talked to Dawn, and she said, "Don't worry, it'll be a silent march." And in fact, it was. And so when they had the election for class president, Dawn lost by just a handful of votes, I think 15. And she lost from a very close friend who ultimately became a very famous person, Match Munchnick, who did Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. And Dawn, she lost running against Max for just a handful of votes. Actually, she had been in the hospital with strep throat, couldn't campaign the end. And so the president asked Dawn to have a recount. And she said, no, I would never do that. Max is so popular. He won fair and square, and he deserves it. And she was the first student ever at Emerson to be placed on the board of trustees in her senior year while still a student because the president didn't want to lose her in student government. So she was just that kind of a person. I really say that she had more of my husband's characteristics. She very much picked up his ways, and they were extremely close. And we were a very close family and still are a very close family. So her loss was sorely, sorely met.
Well, I think a testimonial to who she was is that you're telling us 28 years after her passing that the man she was either engaged to or about to be married
never married.
But they were on their way,
yeah,
that he still
is single.
Is single,
yeah,
and still
close
loves
to our
her.
Family.
Still
and
loves
still
her. That's pretty amazing.
Yes, and is still very close to our family. As but, is his sister. Both he and his sister are godparents for our grandchildren. So we've stayed very close with them. But at the end of the day, when Dawn ended up dying, and then we were out of the country, and she was taken by the coroner, of course. And when we got to the coroner's office, this man who was very big and had this big silver cowboy buckle on his belt and cowboy boots and really a giant of a man, but with this gentle heart. And he said to me, "You know, Mrs. Gross, your daughter had such a gentle spirit when I entered her apartment, and I've separated her from others in the morgue, and I've put flowers by her feet." And I was so moved by that. Of course, along with that, he suffered in telling me that we could not see our daughter, and that it was going to take a week to do the autopsy because, unbelievably, in that year, 1990, in April, it was Ramadan, it was Passover, and it was Good Friday. So everything was on hold. So it was, and almost in the most smooth segue, he moved my husband into another room so that he could identify our daughter's body.
Wow. Well, it seems to me that she was quite an extraordinary spirit.
She was a sweet person. But, you know, we all have a story.
Yes.
And we all feel this way about the people we love. But Dawn was a very kind, sweet person who wasn't small in any way. She had a generous heart, and she didn't get caught up in the small things that a lot of people get.
And, you know, this is something that happens all the time whenever someone passes who is good and kind. And then we think about, I mean, I can think about right now about a half a dozen people who are very old and who might have been taken from us to relieve the stress.
You know, Georgiana, you're again hitting on something that's so powerful, but it's something that I believe, I can't answer for anyone else. I do really believe that each of us has a destiny. I do. And I think we can affect destiny until a point. The Buddhists say until karma is ripe, but then even God doesn't interfere. And I notice with parents and loved ones and mates that they're pushed out of the way when it's their loved one's time to die, because it is their time to die. And so many times, you know, parents beat themselves up with all the should-haves and could-haves and the guilt. Oh, there's always guilt assigned to loss, especially if it's your child and you're called upon to defend your child, to, you know, throw yourself in front of a bus for your child, and here you could do nothing. And so there's always guilt that accompanies death. But at the end of the day, none of us have a crystal ball. None of us actually know what the future can hold in the very next second of our lives. So if we did have a crystal ball, we would do things differently. But in the realm of what we actually know and can know, we did the best we could with the information at hand. And so I tell this to parents who feel guilty and really let that guilt inform then the rest of their grieving, that at the end of the day, none of us know the time of death, not our own death or the person we love. Only God knows that. And at the end of time, this is really a destiny.
Well, I believe that's a biblical and Torah passage, for we will not know the day or the time. I mean, it's a constant reminder that we always have to be our very best selves in our lives. Now, there's so much to talk about, and we never have enough time. So what I'd like to ask you to do, because we're going to have to take another break in about 5-6 minutes, is to start on the chapters of your book. You have a 10-step program. And those 10 steps, I'm just going to say them real quick, and then you can expound on them. Courage and choice, real life, the mourning process, guilt in search of a transgression, surrender to the process. Boy, is that the killer right there. That's the that's the middle, that's that real bump in the road, the valley of despair, and then the personal life review. Then there's a rebirth, and we create our own ritual to withdraw and return to the womb and heal. Then there's relationships and self-investment back into life. Now, they all sound wonderful and painful. So,
and you're right on both counts. But this was the journey that I discovered for myself. And it really is the journey that saved my life.
Okay. And I think if you would share that with us, you may save someone else's life with that information. Okay.
Thank you.
Why don't you jump right in?
Okay.
We're not going to take a break for another 5 minutes.
Okay. So courage and choice. Well, you know, when you lose a child, I don't care who the parent is, or when you lose a loved one, a mate. You know, my own father-in-law and mother-in-law were very, very close. He died. She died. And 6 weeks later, he died. He wasn't sick. He was actually moving in with us. We built an apartment for our parents in our own home so that no one would have to, you know, have caretakers outside of the family. And so really it was just their closeness pulled him into death. I'd never seen the mind turn off the body before, but I did when he died. So you have to choose life. You have to make a conscious decision that you're going to go on, and there are ways to go on. Of course, in the beginning, religion, if you have religion, can help you. And in the Jewish faith, which I'm in, of the Jewish faith, we have rituals that inform that first year of grieving, and especially the first week. We cover the mirrors, we light candles, we rent our clothes at the edge of the cemetery, because we want to remind ourselves that, yes, we have a wound to our heart, a tear, if you will, and it will repair. It'll always have a scar, and it will repair. And then we go on with what we call Shiva, and people come and visit with us. And the wonderful thing about this approach is that people help hold our burden with us in that first week, and we get a chance to talk about our feelings in a safe space, and we don't have the ability to bring up any defenses, so it's very cathartic. And it's only when those people leave that we start moving slowly, slowly out of shock. And then it's very important to keep it simple. Pay attention first to your physical needs, because people die when they lose their people that they love. They die from shock, from heart attacks, from cancer. The immunities go down. The T cells and lymphocytes, these all can be measured, and we now know that antigens, which are our immunities, absolutely are vulnerable and drop when catastrophe strikes. So we have to treat ourselves as if we were our own child, and just as a discipline, get enough rest, get enough food, just pay attention to the basics. Try to get some exercise, which helps stimulate endorphins and helps regulate stress. And then surrender to your grief. You know, laugh if you want to laugh. Cry if you want to cry. Don't go out if you don't want to go out. Go out if you want to go out. Just keep it really easy for yourself and be gentle with yourself. Let yourself have your grief, because people who grieve can live again.
Mm.
And then you have to make this commitment to life, and then you have to take some action, just one step at a time, to affirm that life, and always ask for help. But when you ask for help, this is so important. You have to know who to ask. You know, it's very important to ask people who can really help you. And if you need a psychiatrist or a psychologist, go there. If you need medication, take it. It's not going to be forever, but you will be given a behavior modification model. You will be given a therapy. You will be given a process from which to follow a path forward. And you'll be able to go into a safe place, a container, once a week or twice a week, to talk about your grief, to face it. Because in the end, you have to face it. You know, we all use words like loss. We all use words like my loved one's not with me anymore. But we have to face that person we love is dead. They're gone. And now, how are we going to go on? That's very important. And then to find places like Compassionate Friends, places where you can be with people like you who have experienced what you're experiencing. It's like a group therapy. It's the best of group therapy. Because in such a place, you are with others who can meet you at your edge, who really know what it is. As I said, I was a very compassionate person before Dawn died, and empathetic, but until I lost my own child, I really didn't understand how completely deconstructing loss is. And I never was a therapist, because my professor used to say to me, "You're too empathetic, Gail. You should lecture, teach, be a resource, but don't have patience." And so, you know, I always considered myself empathetic, but until my child died, I really didn't understand what it was to really say goodbye. And rituals help us because ultimately, every ending is a beginning and every ending signals a transition and every transition signals a transformation. So therefore, we need rituals. Most cultures have a ritual. And when you move out of childhood into adolescence, you know, in the Jewish faith, there's a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. In Christian faith, many times there's a confirmation. But nevertheless, there's some ritual to signal there's a change afoot. And there is no ritual for death. And there is a huge change now afoot after death. So we have to create our own rituals. And that those rituals allow us to mourn. And mourning is different than grief in that it's a process. And there are a lot of red flags to look for when you're mourning. You're in so much pain that if you ever had an addiction, you'll reach for that now. If you ever had something you did, like smoking or something that you gave up, you'll reach back for that because at the end of the day, your pain level is so high, you're trying to get relief from mm-hmm. that pain. And it's important to take command of yourself, to stay conscious and say, you know, I need relief, but I'm not going to allow myself to become addicted. And that is a very, very important part of grieving because when you surrender to the process and you allow yourself to feel your feeling, then synchronicity happens. And the most amazing people come to you to try to help you because you've opened the space to allow them in.
Exactly. So, Gail, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
I can't believe it.
I mean, the time with you has just, it's just gone by so quickly. We're going to take just a quick break. We're coming back. Don't go anywhere. We want Gail to continue to walk us through the 10 steps. Be right back.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donatio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
We are back with Dr. Gail Gross, who is the author of The Way Out is Through, a 10-step journey from grief to wholeness. Gail, what step were we on before the break?
Well, so we're on three, and we've already covered that, guilt in search of a transgression. And we talked about that earlier, that really no one has a crystal ball. We don't know the time of death of ourselves or our loved ones. If we did, we'd do all the right things all the time. But we don't, so we do the best that we can with what we know, and that's what we ultimately have to come through.
Yes.
And that's where we help ourselves. Because if we stay with guilt, we never live again.
Gail, we have about 7 minutes left.
So I'm going
to... And we want to talk about the steps, and then we want to get a lot of information about how people can reach you, how they can interview you, how they can go to your website and buy your book. So if you'd take us through the next six steps.
Well, I'm just going to quickly say, because we've already said this next step, which is 4, surrender to the process, let yourself have your grief. Then number 5, which I consider the most important step, and that's the valley of despair. And so I'll just take a moment to explain that before trauma, we are in a certain container that holds our persona, and that is who we are. It informs us. It's our patterns from our childhood. In everyone's life, from birth to death, there really are only 2 people, mother and father. You and I, Georgiana, are thinking we're having a conversation, but it's you and me and your mother and father and my mother and father. We're all along because it's really those patterns we learned in our family of origin that inform our behavior. But once trauma happens, we're thrown out of that set. And for a small period of time, we're in a space, I call it the valley of despair, where there are no structures. And because there's nothing familiar there, most people don't have the courage to stay there. They have to lower their anxiety, and they rush back to what is familiar, the old patterns and the old ways that inform them from their family of origin. But if you hang out in the valley of despair, hold the tension of your grief, and face your shadow, which is all the disowned material from childhood that we have disowned about ourselves, and if we hang out with that, really what we're hanging out with is the split within our psyche, the shadow and the light. And if we become conscious through the inner work we do in the valley of despair, journaling, paying attention to our dreams, meditation, which all give us access, which are all vehicles, which give us access to our own unconscious, then from that space, we recognize what our patterns are, what we're projecting out onto others, and we find a home for it consciously within ourselves. And when we do that, we integrate and that split in our psyche. When we integrate our disowned material, our projections back into our psyche consciously, then all the energy we use to suppress our feelings unconsciously is released. And that's our creative energy, which comes back to us. That's what gives us our libido back. That's what gives us our vitality for life. And that's what drives us forward into renewal and rebirth. And so the fertility for our growth is actually in the valley of despair. And so that is an inversion process, and it requires us to spend time alone, whether it's a certain amount of time each day as a discipline, like meditation or dream analysis, or whether it's going away to a cabin for a week, which I think is the best possible thing, away alone if you can do it, where you're with yourself and you can then go into the interior. It's, you know, the line in the Bible, be still and know that I am God. It's only through the stillness that we can have a soul retrieval and find ourselves again. And then, of course, we go out from that. And I like to talk about making a history because, you know, of course, the ancients all made what they call recapitulation. The shamans all followed such a process. And that really requires making a history of your family's patterns of grief, your high moments, your low moments of living. And when you see it written down on paper, you can come to terms with how those that grieved before you grieved, how those patterns inform your behavior now, and then how you can bring them to consciousness so that you can choose what behaviors to use rather than be compelled by your projections. That's the key to individuation. That's the key to listening to your inner voice. That's the key to finding your true vocation. You have to recognize and acknowledge these patterns, separate from them so you can see them and be objective, and then integrate them back. And when you integrate them back, you're not doomed to act them out in a reactive way, but rather to consciously choose what serves you and be able to call upon what serves you when you need it. There are many trees in all of our forests, the wounded child tree, which can never heal, the adult tree that can act for the wounded child and has the capacity to help when we need it. And there, the happy tree, the sad tree, the greedy, the generous, the rejecting. That's what it is, as Freud said, to be human. It's the human dilemma. But consciousness gives you choice. And it's that free will, that choice that we inherited in the Garden of Eden when we became conscious through eating of that poor named apple, which was probably a fig. And it is through that that we then become whole again. Because by bringing the shadow back, integrating the disowned parts of ourselves, we can choose how to be. That's rebirth.
So beautiful. So beautifully said. I just want to interject this for those of you like myself who may be listening to this and going, yeah, but it is excruciatingly painful, terrifying, and quite frankly, probably the biggest challenge for any of us. Whether it's the loss of love, whether it's the loss of a loved one, or the loss of anything that we're so deeply attached to, it requires humility.
Yes.
It requires surrender. It requires
surrender.
All of that. And I just want to say to those who are listening, read the book, but don't feel bad if you're not there yet, okay? I want to say this as a human being who's been through my own difficulty. Sometimes we're unable to. It doesn't mean that it won't happen in 6 months or next year. So if you can use Dr. Gross's book as a guide, if you can understand the concept of being broken in order to be mended, it will make it easier. And don't give up. Don't give up. Gail, I cannot thank you enough.
I would like to say to surrender to the process and to think of marriage. You know, this is the one person who understands where you are. Of course, he's grieving too, or she's grieving too, so you can't help each other. But let each other know that you love each other. Don't have yet another loss. 80% of all people that suffer the loss of a child end in divorce. So
yes,
it's important to let each other have the ebb and flow of the rhythm of their own grieving process. As you say, surrender to that process.
Yes.
That'll help you. You know, Jung made this great sentence, which sums up what you said, which everything you said was so brilliant, really. But he says, the most dangerous trip you'll ever take is into the unconscious, and yet it is the only trip worth taking. And Aristotle called that trip interiorism. That is 99% of who we are is the unconscious, and it's organizing our environment to bring us to consciousness. So all of your listeners there today, you and I, we are here for a reason. Each of our unconsciouses organized this event today for us to be together for something for each of us. So
absolutely.
With that, I say thank you.
Oh, Gail, I just want to say that if Dawn is listening, you are carrying her goodness and her kindness into the world, and it is a blessing for all of us to have had you as a guest today. Thank you and bless you.
Thanks.
And listeners, be back next week for another truly inspiring and uplifting story on Living Above the Drama.